and he was going to take the challenge. In the new Russia, the media was privately owned, but with the right impetus of billionaires or FOVs, friends of Vladimir, he could pool resources and buy out the Russian media one TV network and newspaper at a time. Over the next few years, he did just that. The Color Revolutions. By 2010, American and NATO expansion in Eastern Europe and Ukraine was starting to chafe Putin. In his first term, he had brought Chechnya to heel and installed a reliable warlord as governor. Stability was returning with increased oil and gas exports to Europe, which buoyed the economy, but it was not steady. Despite oil and gas making up 50% of the country's revenue, the average Russian family remained economically depressed. But Putin was very wary of turning to the West for help, though under Yeltsin, Russia had participated in the Partnership for Peace, a NATO initiative that brought Russia into a tacit alliance with the U.S. Putin felt the United States was playing heavy-handed politics now that the Soviet Union was gone. It was intervening wherever it wished, such as in Bosnia-Herzegovina in the 1990s. As I mentioned, the decision by George W. Bush to invade a former client state, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, eroded the U.S.-Russia relationship. Putin believed that America should not act unilaterally and challenged the Bush administration's goals. Many Russian political elites felt the Bush administration had not consulted with Russia on the matter, as his father George H.W. Bush had during the first Iraq War. Some of Russia's few remaining allies were being seduced by calls to join the West, while others like Ukraine were being used as buffers between the two opposing spheres of influence. Democracy was spreading faster than Putin would like, and these nations' alliances with Washington were sapping the leverage Russia had over them as former Soviet states. A series of cultural revolutions called Color Revolutions took former Soviet states quickly out of Moscow's sphere and into NATO's. That worried Putin. The first was the Rose Revolution in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia in 2003. A predominantly Orthodox nation, they sought extremely close ties to the United States, which they received. It was quickly followed by the 2004 Orange Revolution in Ukraine. This wave of desire for Western-style freedom and democracy soon spread to the Russian-occupied Baltic countries. In quick succession, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia declared independence from the Russian sphere of influence. As a buffer to future interference from the Kremlin, they all joined both the European Union and NATO in 2004. The 2005 Kyrgyzstan's Tulip Revolution happened, though it didn't drive as big of a wedge in U.S.-Russia relations as the previous two. Putin's military influence forced the U.S. to evacuate its base at Manas Airport in 2013. Putin was particularly concerned about regions in Europe with ethnic Russian or pro-Russian Slavic populations. One group was the Slavs in the former Yugoslav nation of Serbia. They had suffered a humiliating political defeat in a war with NATO that had injected democracy into their political system and had displaced the two Serbian ultra-nationalist leaders, Slobodan Milosevic and Ratko Mladic. Both would be hunted, captured, and sent to the International Criminal Court in The Hague for genocide trials. The Serb grip on Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Macedonia, and Montenegro had been broken due to NATO, and Moscow did not like it. In 2008, adjacent Kosovo declared independence and was occupied by NATO forces. Once again, to Putin, this was a nearly intolerable encroachment by NATO on traditionally Slavic parts of Europe. It was bad enough that Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia had joined NATO and were on his borders with his allies in Belarus and Ukraine. 2008 led to numerous clashes with Russia in unrecognized breakaway regions such as South Ossetia and Abkhazia in the Republic of Georgia. Though the elected president of Russia in 2008 was Dmitry Medvedev, he was just considered a placeholder by most Russians until the constitution could be changed for less frequent elections so Putin could return to his post. While Medvedev acted as a seat warmer, Putin's spies in the FSB, GRU, and SVR were exercising his new strategy of hybrid warfare, an amalgam of cyber, special operations, and intelligence activities. They were to carry out political warfare missions just short of open war and push back NATO's influence. Georgia was the first unit on the testbed of hybrid war. In 2008, Georgia had restarted trade with Abkhazia, the small seaside oblast to their northwest, soon after the government of former Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze folded. Eduard Shevardnadze had started making overtures to the United States and NATO. Georgia has always laid claim to Abkhazia, and the Georgian government beefed up its military presence there. Abkhazian separatists armed and started to ethnically cleanse Georgians from the region. This led to Georgian forces engaging in combat against them. At the request of the Abkhaz, Russia decided to intervene and assisted their side in the 13-month war that followed. Russian military forces fought alongside the separatists with tanks and aircraft. But during the Russian attack, a new dimension was added. Russian intelligence cyber warriors cut off all of Georgia's internet access to the world. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov tried to justify the actions of the Kremlin. He claimed they needed to protect ethnic Russians living in South Ossetia and Abkhazia. But it was both from irredentist motives and a warning shot to stop Georgia from joining NATO. Putin believed that the democratic movements that were building in these former Russian states were orchestrated and or supported by the U.S. via the CIA and non-governmental organizations. He openly claimed they brought with them NATO troops and cultural changes that Russians found distasteful. America had dedicated itself to pushing liberal democracy worldwide since the end of World War II, and Russia had succumbed to the demand for freedom. Look what it wrought. America's embrace of ethnic diversity, a gay sexual revolution, and slovenliness had sought to wrench Russia apart. To Putin, America and Europe represented weakness. They had sought to remove from his people the national rigidity in the once strong Soviet Union. Putin's advisor, Gleb Pavlovsky, characterized how he was seen as a savior and problem solver for the population once he pushed back against America. We saw some fluctuations after Putin's strong actions. We saw that people became pathologically addicted to Putin. In case of any crisis, people would look up to him. The Ukrainian Orange Revolution occurred in 2004. When people demonstrated in the streets at Maidan Square after an election where it was found that the results were rigged in favor of Viktor Yanukovych, a pro-Moscow strongman whose campaign was financed with Russian money. Putin funneled an estimated $500 billion into his election campaign and provided campaign helpers who fixed the election. The election was held again, and Yanukovych's opposition, Viktor Yushchenko, won. However, before he won the runoff election, Yushchenko was poisoned by a powerful chemical, TDD, a form of dioxin, and the handsome Ukrainian's face was horribly disfigured. A warning from Putin. In 2010, Yanukovych ran for president again and won by a slim margin. He continued the corrupt practices of using the state-owned gas company for personal benefit. Russia kept Ukraine within its influence, using the price of gas it supplied to Ukraine as incentive to create favorable policies related to Russia. It should be noted that one of Yanukovych's principal foreign advisors was an American named Paul Manafort. In 2008, Ukraine had begun discussions with the European Union to create an association agreement that would ultimately allow Ukraine a special trade arrangement with the EU. In 2013, under Yanukovych, Negotiations intensified with the EU, which had certain requirements prior to proceeding. Meanwhile, Putin offered large gas discounts and loans to Ukraine if Yanukovych didn't sign the deal. In February 2014, when Ukrainians learned the news that Yanukovych dropped the deal, the number of protesters who had been camping out in Maidan Nezalezhnosti Square grew to tens of thousands. After a serious crackdown on protesters that left many bloodied and included government-controlled snipers killing over 100 protesters, Yanukovych agreed to new elections, but the next day, he fled to Russia. After the fall of Yanukovych, Russia moved troops into East Ukraine and provided heavy weaponry to Russian-supported militants in Luhansk and Donbass. Both were ethnically Russian border areas, Russian-armed and agitated for these fighters to seize and separate these regions from Ukraine. After Russian separatist fighting commenced with Ukrainian army forces, the U.S. and EU added a second level of sanctions against Moscow. On July 17, 2017, with Moscow's direct assistance, Russian-backed militants targeted and shot down a Malaysian airliner, an MH17 that was flying from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur. The plane crashed and killed 303 passengers and crew. The U.S. and EU added more sanctions against Russia. This was the final straw for Putin. He was determined to seize Crimea from Ukraine, sanctions be damned. Gleb Pavlovsky told American television, "Putin said if Ukraine is to join NATO, it will join NATO without the Crimea, and when he came back from a meeting with Bush in 2008, Putin started developing a plan for taking Crimea. It's not that he did it personally. The chief of staff was given this task and they developed a plan and that plan stayed in the safe box for 7 years. In 2014, Russia sent special forces without insignia to take over governmental administrative buildings in Crimea. Crimea was a peninsula that was part of Ukraine but had an ethnic majority of Russians. Claiming that they were assisting Russians in crisis, Putin held a referendum that violated the Ukraine constitution and annexed the territory through armed force. The UN did not recognize the annexation of Crimea as Russian territory, and Russia's actions resulted in the EU and US sanctions against the Russian government. According to the United Nations Human Rights Office of the High Commissioner, UNHCR, as of May 2017, the death toll due to the Crimea conflict is at least 10,090 people. Additionally, over 2,777 civilians have been killed and almost 24,000 people injured. The UNHCR estimates that there are more than 1.6 million people who have been internally displaced. This brought about another round of crippling sanctions from President Obama and the European Union. The game was now set as to which side would prevail. Russia wanted to expand, stop, and get its money back. Obama held NATO, the EU, and its sanctions over their heads like the sword of Damocles. Putin decided to change the nature of the game entirely. If he could not get rid of sanctions, he would get rid of the political systems that imposed them. The New Politburo. If a secret cabal was going to be formed in order to push the election of Donald Trump, then Putin's personal star chamber of close friends would make the judgment on what actions to take. Putin has a small group of advisors, all ex-KGB spies and natives of St. Petersburg, known as the Siloviki, but they could be best described as the four horsemen of the KGB. The first of Putin's loyalists is Igor Sechin, the chairman of Rosneft, an oil company owned by the Russian government. In the oil industry, he is called the Darth Vader of Russian oil. Putin appointed him in 2004. When Putin was deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, Sechin worked as Putin's chief of staff and was the leader of the former intelligence officers who surrounded Putin. He served in Africa as a KGB officer and military operations translator in Angola and Mozambique in the 1980s. In 2011, Sechin secured a deal with then-CEO of Exxon, now Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, for an agreement between Rosneft and Exxon to drill in the Arctic. Tillerson's ExxonMobil had previously been negotiating this deal with Yukos. According to Mikhail Khodorkovsky, it was Sechin who drove the effort to destroy Yukos, which resulted in Khodorkovsky being forced to sell his shares to the Kremlin and flee Russia. He was also accused of having a hand in the arrest of Vladimir Yevtushenko, owner of oil and gas company Bashneft. Like Khodorkovsky, Yevtushenko was arrested and imprisoned until he turned over his shares of Bashneft to the government. Sechin's net worth is close to $200 million, but the actual value of his worth is considerably higher thanks to his proximity to Putin. Not one for criticism or public scrutiny. Sechin famously sued Russian media outlets Vedomosti Novaya Gazeta and RBC because they identified that he and his wife Olga luxuriated on a 280-foot near $200 million Dutch-built yacht named Saint Princess Olga. Sechin was awarded $49 million in fines against the paper for libel. However, all the newspaper did was publish the owner's details of the boat. The second horseman is Sergei Borisovich Ivanov, who served as chief of staff to the presidential executive office from December 2011 to August 2016, a seat previously held by the Russian clandestine Foreign Intelligence Agency, SVR chief, Sergei Naryshkin. Also a former KGB officer, he attended the Red Banner Institute in the early 1980s and spent nearly 20 years in the third department of the first main directorate focused on the UK, Australia, New Zealand, and Scandinavia. This led him to field intelligence assignments in Finland and Kenya. Under the Russian Republic, he served in the SVR as first deputy director of the European department. In 1998, he went to the FSB to serve as deputy to then-director Vladimir Putin. His duties brought him to lead the Department of Analysis, Forecasts, and Strategic Planning. When Putin became prime minister, he joined as head of the Russian Security Council and as Putin's envoy to U.S. President George W. Bush. A longtime Putin loyalist, Ivanov served under several positions of trust. From 2001 to 2007, he served as Minister of Defense. From 2005 to 2007, he filled the role of Deputy Prime Minister, then as First Deputy Prime Minister from 2007 to 2008. In the first Medvedev administration, he returned as Deputy Prime Minister from December 2011 and remained under Putin until 2016. Soon after the hacking of the DNC was exposed, he was replaced by Anton Vaino in August 2016 in an inglorious announcement. Russian President Vladimir Putin has decreed to relieve Ivanov of his duties as head of the Russian presidential administration. It was reported as a firing, but among old KGB officers, this may have been a tactical reassignment to show he had nothing to do with the operations. He was subsequently assigned a post for transportation and environmental policy. The third horseman is former KGB and FSB officer Viktor Ivanov. He served as the director of the Russian Federal Service for the Control of Narcotics, FSKN, from 2008 until it was dissolved in 2016. He served as a KGB and FSB officer from 1977 to 2000. He served as Chief of Internal Affairs and was appointed Deputy Director of the FSB under Vladimir Putin from April 1999 to January 2000. He was made Deputy Head of the Presidential Administration on January 5, 2000, serving until he was made Assistant to the President in April 2004. Ivanov was accused of using his power and influence to control Putin's rivals. This included the effort to take down Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the former oil oligarch in charge of Yukos, the oil and gas exploration company. Khodorkovsky was once named by Forbes as the 16th richest person in the world, and was one of the wealthiest oligarchs in Russia until the company was dissolved in 2007. Ivanov was also known for ordering the killing of former KGB officer turned Putin critic Alexander Litvinenko, in which Viktor used a rare poison called polonium-210. Litvinenko had accused Ivanov of being involved with organized crime, notably with the involvement with the Tambovskaya mafia gang led by Vladimir Kumarin. Ivanov was accused of leveraging his power to help the Tambovskaya gang fight their rival, the Malyshevskaya mafia. In a dossier prepared by Litvinenko's colleague, Yuri Shvets, he says that sources claimed Ivanov was a hand, which puts things in order. Shvets said that Ivanov was notably vindictive against anyone who exposed information about him, or more importantly, Vladimir Putin. Nikolai Patrushev is the fourth member of the Siloviki, or Horsemen. He is an ex-KGB officer and the successor to Putin at the Russian intelligence agency, the FSB. It was Patrushev who was chief of the FSB when terrorists blew up apartments around Russia that killed hundreds and conveniently allowed Putin to easily win the presidency on a counter-terrorism platform. It was also his men that were captured planting one of those bombs. He was a chief of dirty tricks and carried out some of the most aggressive punishment campaigns against Putin's enemies. He ordered the assassination of ex-FSB officer Alexander Litvinenko using the radioactive isotope polonium-210 and was known for killing journalists and opposition members. He was an officer of the hardest KGB school of intelligence. Death to enemies of Russia is his apparent motto. He dubbed the Russian intelligence operatives the new nobility of the Federation, and along with Putin, takes a devil-may-care attitude toward their active measures in the West. After a decade running the FSB, he became the head of the State Security Council, where he advises Putin and gets the intelligence agencies and the oligarchy to do Moscow's bidding without question. Putin has used members of security services in almost all key positions in government and the oligarchy since his first term. His trust of ex-KGB and FSB officers would give the new government the feel that the intelligence community was running Russia. Intelligence officers filled key positions in the National Reindustrialization and Modernization Program under Putin. There was no need for political commissars as they ran the ministries and industry. Olga Krishtanovskaya, director of the Center for Elite Studies at the Russian Academy of Sciences Institute of Sociology, told Radio Free Europe what this advisor board of spies desires most. They want an authoritarian modernization. They want a strong authoritarian state of the Soviet type without the Soviet idiocy, said Krishtanovskaya. The idiotic Soviet economy and the idiotic Soviet ideology were minuses. All the rest they want to bring back and preserve, a state system without a separation of powers. Yevgeny Prigozhin, also nicknamed Putin's chef, was a colorful ex-criminal who came to operate a catering company named Concord Management and Consulting, LLC. Concord did, in fact, provide catering, but apparently Putin wanted a loyalist who could operate a non-attributable, off-the-book intelligence support agency. Prigozhin started in St. Petersburg as a hot dog seller and grew to open the most exclusive restaurant in the city, as well as a fast food chain. His entry into Russian government operations came when he was awarded a $1.6 billion contract to cater food for the Russian army. Putin must have had a soft spot for chefs because his father, Spiridon Putin, claimed to be a chef for both Lenin and Stalin in the Soviet Union. At some point, the former convict who spent 9 years in a Soviet penal colony and grew his company in just 11 years became involved in multiple covert operations for the Kremlin. His foray into information warfare was when he opened a fake news factory called Kharkiv News Agency. In 2013, Kharkiv was designed to create false, pro-Moscow people who would hijack website comment pages and disparage the Euromaidan movement, the Ukrainian popular protests to move away from Moscow and toward Western Europe. Putin tapped Prigozhin to set up and operate all of Russia's off-the-books black operations under the guise of the civilian news company. He would also establish the primary generator of fake news in the West, the secret Russian Federation's Internet Research Agency, RFIRA. Prigozhin also runs private security contractors in Syria and Ukraine, and is linked to armed militants in Russian-dominant ethnic regions such as Donbass and Luhansk in Ukraine. These secret contractors have been linked to a secret Russian training base, similar to Blackwater's former North Carolina facility that has been connected with Russian military intelligence. These same mercenaries would eventually come to grief by daring to attack a U.S. Special Forces base in 2018. Among Putin's Russian knights, all were ex-KGB, except for the former criminal-turned-gray-zone dirty-tricks man, Prigozhin. Putin and his advisors aligned for a mission on the U.S., a win to be gained by acting as case officers and coaches to Donald J. Trump. Trump was brash, arrogant, and a colorful character. He could be just the man to help lift the crushing sanctions imposed by Obama and Europe. All evidence from the KGB era and FSB collection would show that he was an easily led person. He had an insatiable desire for respect he was not afforded. With the right whispers in the right ears, perhaps Moscow could get him to adopt positions that most American Republicans would find odious. NATO was knocking on Russian borders, and this had to be stopped. The European Union as a body made Russia's economic life difficult. If the EU could be disassembled through alluring offers of unilateral trade agreements with Washington, then all the better for Moscow. Donald Trump was a unique character to Russia as well as the world. His TV show The Apprentice was loved in Russia. He had come to Moscow's 2013 Miss Universe pageant seeking to kiss the ring of Vladimir Putin. Putin would return the favor by making him President of the United States. The Four Horsemen knew he would be an easily handled asset. Based on my knowledge working in this field for years and the secret intelligence manuals of the KGB, Trump was the kind of quality recruit that spies always sought. Every Russian spy knew that it was the greedy, narcissistic, and self-absorbed conservatives that made for the best assets. Almost invariably, they thought they could handle any situation and rarely looked deeper than their financial pockets. Putin was going to push back against any chance that Hillary Clinton would become president. If that meant having to risk going from a cyber war to a hot war, so be it. Maybe it was time to just introduce a little chaos in America. The American Republican Party had been shifting to the far right for more than two decades. Many of them supported a strong man and powerful national leader like Vladimir Putin. Putin's own contacts with the religious right presented him with the opportunity to co-opt an entire party. It was far too tempting to avoid. If it could be done in the United States, it could be done everywhere else in the world, save China. A successful co-option of the American right would lead to an entire wing of supporters operating the most powerful nation on earth and viewing Putin as its closest ally. Russian intelligence would go back and scrub every document and contact about Donald Trump from his overtures made in the late 1980s. If they could pull it off, why not try? Planning Operation Grizzly Step. Grizzly Step, the operation to destabilize the West and bring Russia to power, would have three legs. One, Russia would use its intelligence services and Prigozhin's gray market civilians to steal information, develop kompromat, and prepare the political propaganda warfare battlefield for intervention in the 2016 election cycle. This planning started in late 2012 and would accelerate in 2013. If Putin's preferred candidate, Donald Trump, didn't rise to the top, then the activities would be launched to create chaos and allow the Republican Party to savagely attack the likely choice, Hillary Clinton, and hound her for the rest of her administration. 2. Russian oligarchs and diplomats would spread into the field and determine who the frontrunners would be and where Russian influence, money, and friendship would be spread. With major financial decisions such as the Exxon deal in the balance, there would be many Americans more than willing to assist Moscow. 3. Kremlin-aligned Russian citizens and like-minded social groups would spread their influence to see if they could co-opt Americans from the far right. Groups that were mired on both sides of the Atlantic included the National Rifle Association, biker gangs, and strongman Americans such as actor Steven Seagal, who, along with others, will extol Russia's support as being a net positive for any conservative. It would mean delicate but open support for extremist, far-right conservatives such as the California and Texas separatist movements, Russian exiles living in the United States, and radicals such as the neo-Nazi movement and Ku Klux Klan, if they could all be brought into a powerful, unofficial coalition. They would align America's cultural losses with the white Christian nationalism they admired in Russia. To begin his mission, Putin would use diplomats to give his plan the social acceptability for upper-class Republican politicians. As all diplomats in the Soviet era were principal points of contact for identification, recruitment, and handoff to the KGB, so were the modern-era diplomats for the FSB and SVR. Diplomats would be the first to look for Americans who were of interest to Russia and who could be exploited by the intelligence services. The top diplomats who have contacts with the Americans would be brought in to ensure a smooth transition. Donald Trump had been fascinated with injecting himself into American diplomacy since 1987. He had met the Russian ambassador and made overtures to coming to Russia to build hotels. His visits during the Soviet era found his affability always increasing when he was in the presence of diplomats. This was to be exploited. Additionally, diplomats were no longer seen as an intelligence threat in America. That oversight would also assist in the recruitment of high-level Americans who could assist without knowing that they were involved in a massive intelligence operation against their own nation. Others, once given promises of access to oil money, wouldn't care. If the Americans were reliable about any one thing, it was that assets and even agents were always easy to buy with Russia's cash. The job of the American wrangling diplomats would be to ensure that they understood Moscow's position and how it could benefit them personally if they were to make certain of these positions in the Republican Party. The point man for this operation would be the ambassador to the United States, Sergei Kislyak. Sergei Kislyak served as the Russian ambassador to the United States from 2008 to 2017. He had served as deputy foreign minister under Sergei Lavrov. In 1977, he had joined the foreign ministry and worked his way up through the ranks as a trade representative during the Soviet era. He became the first secretary at the embassy in Washington, D.C., and soon after that became a trusted negotiator for nuclear arms control treaties with Ronald Reagan's administration. His education as a nuclear physicist gave the Americans trust in his ability to understand complex problems. As with any Soviet-era diplomat, he was required to carry out espionage-related duties. John Barrell said, "In modern Washington, he had to do almost nothing, as Americans fell all over themselves to become friends with Vladimir." If Kislyak was the operative on the ground, then Sergei Lavrov was the heavy above him who was linked directly to Putin. Lavrov was a quiet, unassuming man of considerable girth. As Russian foreign minister since 2004, he was the principal point of diplomacy for Moscow. However, he had other duties assigned. Lavrov was a lifelong career communist functionary. Born in 1950, he was a child in Stalin's Soviet Union and became the secretary of his local Komsomol, the Communist Youth League. He studied and graduated from the Moscow State Institute of International Relations in 1972 and was assigned to the Russian Foreign Ministry under Premier Leonid Brezhnev's regime. In 1994, he was posted to New York as the Russian Federation representative to the United Nations. He earned his stripes during the Obama era as the vocal mouthpiece of Putin's ire. His diplomatic demeanor is a big, fat bulldog, but he can be blunt, direct, brash, and very Russian in countering U.S. positions. In a Newsweek article, John Negroponte, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, referred to Lavrov's style as, "His two objectives were always the same, veto things for the greater glory of Russia, and to take the Americans down whenever possible." This was how Lavrov earned his nickname, Mr. No. Every intelligence operation would need funding. Putin had just the man. Sergei Gorkov was the head of a Russian state investment bank, Vnesh Ekonombank, VEB. Gorkov graduated in 1994 from the same KGB school of intelligence as Putin. He never went into active field operations, which made many believe that after basic service, he was tasked to become a banker spy in an NOC position, non-official cover. These were the deepest of spies, as they had no visible ties to their agencies. He worked his way up through Russian banks, including the Menatep Financial Group under Mikhail Khodorkovsky. This included the oil giant Yukos. In 2002, he attended the G.V. Plekhanov Russian Economic Academy. During his time at Menatep Yukos, he emerged clean from a massive tax scandal that rocked the industry. Khodorkovsky had publicly fought with Putin over corruption and bribes in the government. Putin filed charges against Yukos for tax evasion, fraud, and corruption. Khodorkovsky was arrested and imprisoned for 8 years. His oil company assets were nationalized. Gorkov walked away free and became a close ally of Putin. In 2008, Gorkov worked for Sberbank, Russia's state-owned bank. Not surprisingly, Sberbank is represented in the U.S. by Mark Kasowitz, President Trump's attorney, who was named lead attorney in defending the company in a federal civil lawsuit. In 2016, Gorkov was appointed to head VEB. The VEB is considered to be Putin's personal bank for special projects. It is also under U.S. sanctions related to Russia's invasion and annexation of Crimea and for its reputation as the Bank of Spies. Many Russian intelligence activities were funded from their coffers. Putin's team of wranglers would support the operations that were necessary to stop the encroachment of the United States and particularly that odious Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton. The days of second fiddle to Obama and his incessant talk of spreading democracy would end in 2016 one way or another, and the sanctions would be released. Russia would not respond to America's shoves. Putin did have a vision to destabilize the West. It was a long-ball plan. It would happen when he, Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin, chose. When the plan was executed, he would make Russia great again. Chapter 4. Putin's Philosophy. Russia has long been in flux, with mixed beliefs on what was the most advantageous system for a nation in which three-quarters of its landmass is in Asia, while three-quarters of its population lives in the European quarter. Since the time of Peter the Great's European illumination, the question of the Russian cultural identity has risen to the forefront of discussion. In the age of Putin's neo-tsarist empire, the question is this: does Russia accept the status quo of European and American dominance of the world order, or does it take measures to upset the global center of gravity and forge its own strategic culture? Putin is at a crossroads that many Russians struggle with. For a century, Russians have been conditioned to believe that Western democracy is destined to fail, but when given the chance to embrace it, they did. And many do not like the messy results. Many former communist philosophers emerged from the Soviet debris field and embraced a wild melange of beliefs about the future of Russian identity. Some have emerged as thought leaders that have not only influenced Russia's elite ruling class, but have jumped the Atlantic and acted as a pole star for American conservatives. To many neo-tsarist Russian philosophers, the Soviet Union's traditional leftist and European socialist partners, who were horribly liberal, failed them in the battlefield of ideas. Hence, liberalism of any kind is a mortal enemy that must be vanquished. They embrace the conservative right and teeter close to fascism. Putin is an autocratic ruler, and like every tsar and dictator before him on the global stage, it is imperative that he control the narrative with an intentional philosophy. Gleb Pavlovsky describes it as, he acts as a professor, as a lecturer. He explains to us what Russian history was like, what values we have, what we should believe in. But furthermore, under Putin lies a pantheon of new philosophers who are helping craft the future narrative of both Russia and America. Vladislav Surkov was a Russian businessman and politician of Chechen descent who served as the deputy prime minister of Russia from 2012 to 2013. He was Putin's right-hand man as the first deputy chief of the Russian presidential administration of Vladimir Putin. His career first started as a bodyguard in the 1990s for Mikhail Khodorkovsky. Under Putin, Surkov was more widely known as a Kremlin propagandist. According to Atlantic magazine's Peter Pomerantsev, he is nicknamed political technologist of all of Rus. Many have assumed that Surkov is an éminence grise, a gray cardinal or behind-the-scenes mastermind who pulls the levers of power. As a political technologist, he strengthens Putin's control in Russia through media power. Russia's democracy is a sovereign democracy, a Surkovian term. Via media intervention, it assures that Russia's democracy has a different set of philosophies than other democracies, which under Putin bears a striking resemblance to the true democracy that was always proclaimed under the Soviet Union. It is a society of true democracy, a political system which ensures effective management of all public affairs, ever more active participation of the working people in running the state, and the combining of citizens' real rights and freedoms with their obligations and responsibility to society. Democracy in capitalist countries, where there are antagonistic classes, is, in the last analysis, democracy for the strong, democracy for the propertied minority. In the USSR, on the contrary, democracy is democracy for the working people, that is, democracy for all. Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, founder of the Soviet Union and Marxist-Leninist communism, wrote in a 1917 treatise, The Transition from Capitalism to Communism, "Democracy for an insignificant minority, democracy for the rich, that is the democracy of capitalist society." However, instead of being a bastion of balance and tolerance, Surkov's version of democracy is crafted by a centralized control system for information and narrative manipulation through the use of mind control and influence techniques, and where certain words and images were repeated, mantra-like, over and over. Surkov was focused on ideology. He created covert, fake opposition parties not just in Russia, but in Ukraine as well. He would stage liberal art shows in order for them to be attacked by Greek Orthodox priests. In 2013, Peter Pomerantsev interviewed Surkov in an Atlantic article titled "The Hidden Author of Putinism, or How Vladislav Surkov Invented the New Russia," where Surkov introduces himself as, "I am the author or one of the authors of the new Russian system." Surkov has given talks at prestigious universities and public forums worldwide, despite the fact that he was linked to Nashi, a.k.a. the Hours Movement, a group labeled the Russian pro-Putin version of the Hitler Youth. Surkov organized the group in 2005. He is also renowned in Russia for burning books by democratic authors, deemed unpatriotic writers, in the Red Square. His biggest efforts at censorship involved suppressing liberal media outlet rankings in Yandex, the most widely trafficked search engine in Russia. Since 2009, he has written two postmodern ideology novels, though in 2012 he denied ever having penned them. His first book, Almost Zero, blames liberal society for the bad state of Russia during the fall of communism and rise of capitalism, and his second novel, Mashinka and Velik, introduces a worldview where intellectuals, mafia, sadists, ex-clergy, and professors are all pedophiles and exploiters of children. Many disappeared, all on the same side, the left side. He also published a short story, Without a Sky, in March 2014, a futuristic work complete with technology, robots, warfare, mutants, and underworlds, etc. He published it under the pseudonym Natan Dubovitsky, a nom de plume based on his wife's maiden name, Natalia Dubovitsky. Surkov was allegedly fired by Putin's Kremlin officials in 2011, though it was stated that he had resigned. In Putin's second run for president, Surkov had surprisingly backed Medvedev. He had been verbal with the Russian elite that he supported the liberal Medvedev instead of Putin. He was dismissed from the Putin administration. Considering that Medvedev was a political placeholder for Putin, if they had a falling out, there must be another reason. In 2016, Surkov was put on the U.S. sanctions list for his role in helping fashion the rebellious Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics and agitation in eastern Ukraine. His role was exposed by a group of Ukrainian hackers known as Cyber Junta. Central and Eastern European correspondent Sean Walker wrote in The Guardian, "It is possible that going after Surkov is the first salvo in what the CIA promised would be unprecedented cyber covert action against Russia in the wake of alleged Russian hacking of the Democratic Party's computer networks." Alexander Dugin was a former professor of sociology at Moscow State University and an advocate of neo-Eurasianism, a geopolitical policy that advocates for the seizure of former Soviet Union territories. He has been referred to as Putin's Rasputin by Breitbart News and has become the loudest voice of the Russian fringe as it reflects the global conservative themes prominent in right-wing circles in America and Europe. He was the leader of the National Bolshevik Party, National Bolshevik Front, and Eurasia Party. Dugin created the International Eurasian Movement in 2000 and idealizes the Eurasia concept that Russia is more aligned to the Asian continent. With this philosophy, he seeks to expand Russian control over not only the former Soviet Union territories, but other Asian countries as well. He sees Russia as having gone through a national awakening under Putin's leadership, a Russian spring. "I think that the new Russian identity and ideology will be constructed on the basis of people as the central political reality, not ethnic or racial, but the people as a community." According to Dugin, unipolar globalization brings sociopolitical, ethnic, religious, and national infrastructures into one system. Neo-Eurasianists believe it is Russia's destiny to smash the one nation-state of globalization that is consuming the world into that American transatlantic paradigm. It's a Russian take on New World Order, and it has many American adherents, including Donald Trump and his supporters. Dugin is said to be inspired by the writings of Adolf Hitler and the German philosopher Martin Heidegger. Ironically, he is a staunch advocate against governments and people he calls globalists who, in his words, are in the process of destroying any identity except for that of the individual. His followers include combined tribes of anti-globalists and nationalists. Dugin calls for revolutionary ideas that bear a striking resemblance to a conservative version of the capitalist owner versus proletariat worker rhetoric of communism under which he was raised. He has advocated for a shift to traditional conservative politics to restore the place of the Russian Orthodox religion in public policy. Regarding the United States, Dugin has stated that liberalism in the West has come to an end of its political cycle, and a return to conservative policies was inevitable. For instance, he strongly protested the acceptance of the LGBT community and other policies commonly associated with liberalism. His stances mirror characteristics of American conservative extremists. However, Dugin has no problem recommending unbridled use of Russian military force that he often complains of. In 2008, Dugin called for the seizure of Ukraine and Georgia and to bring them back into the post-Soviet sphere of influence. He has espoused the view that the former Soviet states belong to Russia. These statements are alarming to small NATO nations such as Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia, who only just liberated themselves from Russia. Dugin's brand of radical, almost fascist, conservative populism is very popular in the pro-Trump circles. He endorsed Donald Trump for president in 2016 in an article titled, "Trump is Real America," where he postulated that Trump was a common man of the times and thus a challenge to the global elite. In his YouTube videos, he loudly proclaimed his support for the billionaire. "Donald Trump is the most right-wing candidate of the Republican Party, but not like the insane disabled McCain or the ex-Trotskyist neoconservatives obsessed with the idea of world dominance." He claimed that Trump would reverse the policies that support the transatlantic ties of America and Western Europe. "Trump is the voice of the real right wing in America, which, in fact, doesn't care about foreign policy and American hegemony." On the election of Donald Trump, Dugin pushed his agenda to promote this ideology. "November 8, 2016 was a most important victory for Russia and for him, Putin, personally. This is the real America. The America of realism, which has chosen its president and not succumbed to the false propaganda of the globalist liberal media. More than half of the U.S. population believes only itself, not the lying liberal globalist propaganda of the transnational elites. This is brilliant news. Dialogue can be held with this kind of America. There is nothing more stupid and fake than the American vote-counting system. It is a disgrace and not a democracy." Born July 3, 1974, Konstantin Malofeyev has been likened as Putin's George Soros, without the empathy and dignity. He had 15 years of experience in the world of private equity and investment banking. As founder of Marshall Capital Partners, an international investment fund group, he has amassed a vast fortune in real estate, agriculture, telecommunications, technology, and media investments. He ran the advisory board of St. Basil the Great Foundation, Russia's largest charity, and St. Basil the Great Grammar School, a school he founded in 2007. He is on the board of trustees for the Russian non-government, non-profit Safe Internet League, which led to drafting Russia's original internet censorship law. As president of right-wing think tank Katehon, Malofeyev founded and subsequently funded Tsargrad TV and Tsargrad Media Group. He advocates for a new Russian empire, and in doing so, hosts a media platform for the far right. It includes voices like American conspiracy theorist Alex Jones and Alexander Dugin, as well as a former Fox News anchor Jack Hanek, Emeric Choprade, advisor to Marine Le Pen, Austria's Prime Minister Heinz Christian Strache, formerly the Freedom Party leader, among others. On Twitter, @Katehon was the entity pushing Dugin's Drain the Swamp, a mantra during the election that would become a phrase used by presidential candidate Donald Trump and his followers. In 2014, the Russian opposition hacking group Shaltai Boltai, Humpty Dumpty, released emails between Malofeyev and Georgi Gavrish. The emails revealed a massive effort to prop up extremist right-wing ethno-nationalist groups throughout Europe, including in France, Germany, Italy, Greece, Hungary, Poland, Romania, Slovakia, Croatia, Serbia, and Turkey. Efforts were also underway outside of Europe in Argentina, Chile, Lebanon, and Malaysia. Malofeyev was sanctioned by the Obama administration for being the principal funder of the Ukrainian separatist groups fighting in Donetsk that helped facilitate the seizure of Crimea. Another of Putin's philosophers was Igor Panarin, a Russian intelligence officer and former KGB analyst who worked for the Federal Agency for Government Information and Security, FAPSI, then the Russian equivalent of the NSA. In 2003, FAPSI dissolved and became the Special Communications Information Service. He went on to receive a doctorate in political science with a focus on geopolitics, social psychology, and U.S. economics and information warfare. Panarin is most widely known for announcing his prediction at the Information War Conference held in Linz, Austria on September 9, 1998, nearly 7 years after the fall of the Soviet Union, that the U.S. would face a similar Balkanization fate within the decade, and no later than summer 2010. It was at that conference where Panarin planted the seeds of what many would later come to view as the basis for Putin's disinformation campaign against the United States. Panarin calculated that fear of mass immigration, moral decay, and economic uncertainty could spark disunity within the United States. These factors could result in a civil war, culture war, that could discredit the stability of the U.S. dollar on an international level while undermining globalization. Panarin predicted that there is a 45-55% chance that disintegration will happen. It was met with great skepticism at the conference as he unveiled a map showing the United States, then still in a trade partnership with Russia, broken into 6 parts due to the fact that some economically sound U.S. states would aim to unleash themselves from control from the federal government. At the same time, Alaska, which is only 90 miles from Russia's nearest point, would once again, according to Panarin, become part of Russia, while Hawaii would become a protectorate territory of either Japan or China, and the Californian Republic would be under Chinese influence. CalExit. Additionally, the northern states that Panarin refers to as the Central North American Republic would be taken over by Canada. Not surprisingly, by 2015, the Kremlin would come to financially back some American separatist groups in order to effect this prediction. Panarin's warning to the United States was based on what happened to the Soviet Union. Panarin wrote that Americans expect miracles from President Obama, but when the spring comes, it will be clear that there are no miracles. Panarin cited that the collapse of the Soviet Union was predicted in 1976 by French political scientist Emmanuel Todd, and that people laughed at him as well. Steve Bannon, the American Goebbels. Steve Bannon is the American politician whose ideology has bridged the philosophies of the new Kremlin thinkers with the masses in America. He rose to prominence under Donald Trump, and at a time when Trump looked like he would falter, Bannon led his campaign to victory in the 2016 elections. But once he opened his mouth about his true feelings of Trump's incompetence, while extolling himself as a brilliant kingmaker, he would fall in disgrace. That disgrace did not last long. Bannon started crisscrossing Europe to act as the networker-in-chief to bring his Trumpian-style authoritarianism to European populist groups. In power or not, Bannon would come to be the shining star in the Putin plan to bring America into an alliance of autocratic thought leaders. His ideologies were deeply rooted in Duganism, and that gave him a place in the manipulation chain in the global game of information warfare. If the Americans under him proved as malleable as they were when it came to Moscow's money, then perhaps it was appropriate